Today on Poetry on the Radio, the second of two episodes, in conversation with Owen Bullock, a poet given to uncanny observation, reminiscence, humor, and much else. Owen Bullock grew up in Cornwall and lived 25 years in New Zealand before coming to Australia in 2014 to complete a PhD in creative writing at the University of Canberra, where he now teaches. He has published 4 collections of haiku and a novella, A Cornish Story, which was published by Polaris Press in 2010. Owen Bullock's longer-form version collections are Sometimes the Sky Isn't Big Enough, Steele Roberts, 2010, Semi, Puncher and Wattman, 2017, and from Recent Work Press, Work and Play, from 2016, and his most recent, Pancakes for Neptune, 2023. Pancakes for Neptune begins with his childhood in depressed Cornish mining country and has plenty of criticism for both neoliberal waste and conservative greed, all while being lyrical, an imagist, and even rapturous about the earth. When we left off last week in our conversation, Owen Bullock was telling us about some fusion poems that were particularly exciting to him.
Now, so I'm several books down the track from this. So after this is a book called Shuttle, which is similar to this in terms of celebrating lots of different forms. And that's under consideration at the moment. And then I started writing these poems that I call fusion poems, that instead of keeping all these different forms I write in separate, I munch them all together. So it intersperses prose poems, haiku and tanka, lineated poems, and a lot of found material, because I love found material. I could read you one of those if you like. There's some work in this that I call sem poems that sort of pave the way for the fusion poems. So in the fusion poems, which you can imagine by blending these different forms, they become quite long pieces, but they've gone down all right. They go down well with audiences, and I've gradually managed to get them published, but mainly in online journals, because of course print journals don't really like to publish poems that are 20 pages long, which some of them are. So that's been really fun. I've written 2 books of them. The fusion poems, I felt like, was the first thing I'd ever done that was original. I think most things we do are not original. They're quite derivative. Most poems most people write could have been written 120 years ago. So very little work is, in the pure sense, contemporary. In terms of the way I define that, rather arrogantly, is work that couldn't have been written before now. And I think there's something about the fusion poems that is a little bit more contemporary, so I'm pleased about that. I'll read one from this book that's got a lot of that found material in it. They're also quite fun, because the things people say are just insane.
They are quite fun. As I would encounter them going through the book, it was almost like became just the form itself and the idea. It becomes clear after a while that these are found. And you could almost hear, like, the whispering. I began to think of them as eavesdrop poems. I don't know if that's correct or not.
Oh, absolutely. A lot of them are eavesdrops. I sometimes notate things people say on the bus verbatim. It's quite marvelous. So this poem's got some stuff like that in it. And, yeah, you hear the different voices, eh? And I like writing in different voices and, you know, stealing other people's voices. So this one's called Tongue. Masonic lodges aren't noted for their indoor-outdoor flow. A lot of linen suits in the Canberra poetry scene. My dreams aren't good enough. I dreamed I was boiling pasta. I don't know why I'm exerting pressure. As soon as you get a boyfriend, you stress. Can mung beans go so wrong? My kids are trying to kill me. He even argued underwater. Life's too short for a dollar coin in the trolley. The missing chunks of God. Not all my zombies are carnivores. I still want to go to the footy and have fun. My boyfriend, not my boyfriend. I get it. You're invited, by the way. There's going to be like a dance. A drop-dead date. Now, only one line in that poem was written by me, which is, life's too short for a dollar coin in the trolley. Everything else is found. Yeah, mostly on the bus, but a few other places too.
It delights me too. It's funny that that's the line, because I think that's such a little tip of the cap to Canberra with its, you know, its quirky gold coin trolley system.
Right. Yeah.
It really grounds you in a very specific place, if you know. Before we depart from this book entirely, there is this important thread that runs almost all the way through it. It's about caretaking our world and the environment. And I thought it was really interesting that that theme would be so prominent in a book that was also about your parents, right? Mm. I mean, this idea of Mother Earth, I don't mean to be corny, but this idea of who takes care of us and what we take care of and who we become because of it.
Mm. Yeah, well, there's this concept in Māoritanga in Aotearoa of kaitiakitanga, which is custodianship, the idea that you look after the land, you know, rather than own land. And I really like that idea. And that, I guess, the thing I've enjoyed most about being there, when I've been there, is the land itself. I find the land itself very nurturing. Mm-hmm. Often had wonderful gardens there. I mean, we've got a nice garden here now at a community garden. But yeah, the land and the very air, when I go back there, I really notice that the air is so full of moisture. After a few trips back, I realized that was the difference. And some people find that heavy moisture in the air all the time a bit problematic, but to me, it's very nurturing. So I love being there physically. It's always been a bit difficult for me work-wise, you know. I always struggled to find work in New Zealand, but you know, in that sense, Australia's been kinder. But yeah, I guess I do love the land itself. Maybe I should read some. I think there's a haiku sequence or two that's sort of set there. Here's one. This is a sequence. It's not quite a haiku sequence, but it's very haiku inspired. Yeah, it's a bit of a bridge there. And it was inspired, but whenever I go back, when we've been back in the summer to camp on our piece of land there, I tend to reread the poems of Ryokan, who's a Japanese poet I like, who wrote longer poems and haiku. So I'm very inspired by him. This piece is called Sitting. A yellowhammer lands on a rock, water gleaming. I can't follow the path of ripples on the stream. Among brown cows, one black cow. Sparrows and miners pick at the ground where cows have been. How slowly can I walk through the meadow? Koromiko we planted next to Koromiko that came up. Scratch marks on the old totara, where the possum scurries. Clothes in bundles in the gypsy wagon. Plans to read, but the river more inviting. What passes, glimpsing what passes.
This is just a beautiful example of being so grounded in the senses and being really being, you know, you tell students write about something real because they just want to write about emotions or abstract things, right? That's their impulse. So you've got like cows and minas and sparrows, and that OW sound is quite prevalent in the middle of the poem. And that's right. What I love too, right? Is then there's this attention to sound. And then at the very end, you take that leap. You know, the poem takes that leap to what passes, glimpsing what passes, and that is so abstract.
Yeah, it does and get yet, more abstract at the end. Yeah.
It's gorgeous, right? I mean, that is what a river is.
Sitting. A yellowhammer lands on a rock, water gleaming. I can't follow the path of ripples on the stream. Among brown cows, one black cow. Sparrows and miners pick at the ground where cows have been. How slowly can I walk through the meadow? Coromico we planted next to Coromico that came up. Scratch marks on the old totara where the possum scurries. Clothes in bundles in the gypsy wagon. Plans to read, but the river more inviting. What passes? Glimpsing what passes.
Would you then read something more current?
Sure, yeah. I often write things in a series. Yeah, maybe just read you a little bit of this. As well as write in different forms or blend different forms, I sometimes try and create different forms. And a while ago, I read in the poetry of Philip Salem, who's one of my favorite Australian poets, a particular kind of sequence that I later found out was called an envelope form, where you write a sequence of poems and the last line of one poem is the first line of the next. And I always meant to try that idea, and I tried it out in this sequence where I wanted a tight structure but a very loose content. So this is a very sort of free associative series of prose poems called Chaos Order, so blending chaos and order. And so the last word or phrase of one poem is the first of the next, and then when you get to the very end, it loops back to the first phrase of the first poem. But I'll just read a bit of it. Like, within this structure, I'm just letting myself go crazy. Chaos Order. The text arrives an hour too late. It could have saved her life, but you only hear her voice, see her hands. You wanted to save her. She gave you such life. She was a presence, a blue goddess. Yes, blue. Was she happy? Was she well? Was she negative? Was she positive? Did she judge? Was she electrons? Was there something in the air, in the offing, planned? How can you know anything about the future? You can't. And yet, what's intuition? What's psychic? Advanced, subtle intuition? I don't know. People say that, and then say something. Say something. You're all the way here. Toes march, legs swing, surge, pivot, hips circle. Enough. Body balance, torso. Take movement snacks to help you through the day. In your head, you have been. There's a working group for tragedy. We don't see it coming. Scramble. There are only ever ideas. Until. Until. Stars sparkle. The moon rises clear each night. The sun balances shade. Seas crash. The forest weeps slowly enough for us to gather grief. The frost gallops in and out again. We realize the chill. Okay, I must make a start. Get my spade and cut through to waist height. Doesn't take long to be out of my depth. Then I get a ladder. Keep slashing. It's not the downward movement of old. Because I want to get away. Chase the shuttle. One spade width at a time. I can spend an hour a day on this. The shuttle's loaded with billionaires' money. But I've got persistence. I'll get away. Past the moon. Hail the sparklers. Look back at where I used to be. As distant from my limitations as it's possible to be. And one day embrace the sun. The sun told you to wake up. It's always awake. What are you waiting for? You only have to make mouse steps. Edge to the dance. The long, slow notes. Warm breath. Cold breath. Even tone. Intonation tonguing. First, open the case. Hook the strap around your neck. Put the reed in your mouth to wet. Whilst you hook on the body, attach the neck. Align with the body. Place the reed on the mouthpiece. Center the ligature. Attach to the neck. Align. Breathe. Make offering to silence before any notes.
Today, I'm continuing to talk to Owen Bullock about his broad range of writing, which takes in varieties of verse and prose. I was going to ask you if you could talk about music, because instruments, music comes up in your poems. And boom, there it is. You've been a musician your whole life?
I don't think of myself as a musician. I think of myself as a singer. I'm more confident singing than playing an instrument. Like, I would get up and sing in front of a million people, but if I get up and play an instrument, I get a bit nervous. Although the last time I played, I've been learning the saxophone this last year, so that poem hooks onto that. And I played the saxophone for the first time at my teacher's student concert, and I wasn't nervous, so that was good. I think nerves are a thing of the past now. I've been playing music since I was about 14. Like, I started writing songs and poetry about the same time. But I was always self-taught with music, and, you know, my knowledge a bit patchy. And I decided recently I wanted to start again with a new instrument and with a teacher. So I'm learning a lot from him, and that's great. But, yeah, I do love music. And, you know, probably when I retire, I'll spend more time playing music than writing as possible. Yeah.
Why did you choose the saxophone?
A few years ago, I taught myself to play the clarinet a bit, but found the embouchure difficult. But, you know, it's a crazy instrument to try and teach yourself because of the embouchure difficulties, technicalities. And then one night I was at a party where somebody had a saxophone. They said I could have a go, and I picked it up. And I was away. It was easy compared to the clarinet. So I always had in mind, oh, maybe I should have tried the saxophone. So more recently I made that choice, and I wanted to do something new.
Poetry on the Radio producer Peter Monahan asked,
you're talking about being a musician brings to mind your comedy in some of your poems, and being funny is a way of presenting and, in a sense, imposing oneself. Is that an impulse apart from your poetry as a whole, do you think? You do occasionally comment on how funny people are, but you also employ some forms that are quite witty, like your quasi-limericks are funny in part because they're quasi-limericks, as well as being funny in and of themselves in their content.
I did go through a phase. My previous book had quite a lot of limericks in it because I was working with a colleague, Tony Eaton, who is a novelist, a very successful novelist, and often teases poets about not writing enough limericks. So I was working with him, and I thought, yeah, I'll spend a few weekends writing limericks. And I got really into them. And I think you can learn everything you need to know about metered poetry from limericks. It's a real challenge. But the humor thing, to me, life is funny. Often humor isn't, or comedy. You know, like I like the cosmic joke, if you like. You know, to me, there's a lot of humor, for example, in Leonard Cohen, when he writes long lines like, I'm wanted at the traffic jam. They're saving me a seat. A few years ago, I've recently got to know again a poet called Kai Jensen, who lives on the South Coast, who was a bit of a mentor to me when I was first trying to get my work published. And I really admired the humor in his work. And I found it frustrating that there was no humor in my work at that time, or I'm talking 25 years ago. And when I just accepted that I was me and not Kai or anyone else, gradually humor came out. But I'm not sort of trying to be funny, particularly. There's just things that occur that to me seem all part of the cosmic joke or part of laughing at the abyss, as it were, that it just has to come out. And I sometimes get a bit of a vibe from poets of, oh, you know, maybe I'm not a very serious poet because there's humor. But, you know, I work very seriously to shape and edit the poems. So I think, you know, we can recommend seriousness rather too much in poetry. And life is funny. And there are funny moments, even when someone's just died or when something very strange or awful has happened. And, you know, again, like part of the acceptance of things as they are, that's part of life. You know, funny things happen all the time. But I hope I'm not trying to be funny.
No, it just happens. It's a lot like juxtaposition. It's an understatedness, and things align in a certain way, and you realize, oh, that's funny.
related to that maybe is that funniness is funniest when you hear it. It's a lot easier to pick it up when I've heard you read your quasi-limericks, for example. But in one of your earlier books that I was reading, it struck me that you almost, it's very difficult to read on the page, actually, because you're not quite sure of what the relation is between the different parts, the different words, and it struck me that perhaps it was almost necessary to hear it spoken to get what's going on.
I think that can be said of any poetry. You know, like so often the reaction of people at poetry readings, particularly if they're hearing poets who are effective for the first time, is, you know, how much better it is hearing it live. I mean, for all of us, as long as the poet's a reasonably good performer, that is the case. You do get an enrichment. And yeah, maybe I'm quite performative because I like performing in other ways. So that might apply to me a little bit more than some poets, that I'm sort of performative in my way of going about things anyway. So yes, probably the best version is going to be live rather than on the page. You know, I'm quite open to that idea. So going back to humor, one of the things I've learned, I guess there have been times when I've wanted to create something that people would laugh at. I mean, I think my job as a writer is to move people's emotions. So at a gig, if I can make people laugh or cry or both, I'm happy. I'm doing my job. You know, I'm very happy if I make people cry. I'm very happy if I make people laugh. They're, to me, of both equal value. So, but some I've noticed over the years, because I did do a bit of theatre at one stage and, you know, perform some juggling and stuff like that. And I've noticed, though, that, yeah, there's another level to things actually not being funny at all until they're performed. Like sometimes I've told a friend or a partner about an idea I have to perform, and they've almost routinely, like, I mean, 90%, 95% of the time, they've said, what? Don't know, Owen, if that's really going to work. Like, is that going to be funny? You know, and I've learned, and I've since encountered this suggestion from other performers, don't tell people your ideas. Just do it. Just do it. And the same people who are skeptical about something, when you actually hear you do it, they'll laugh as well. You know, so there's something about humor, of course, that doesn't bear any kind of explanation. Again, it's just got to be presented. And then it might work. So I know now to keep my own counsel and just plan things and rehearse. And, you know, and I rehearse. I rehearse my poetry readings, you know, many times. Like, I don't just get up and read a poem.
Right.
I rehearse. Yeah.
Yeah. You're writing a different kind of book, too. You're writing a textbook right now.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I got a book proposal accepted a little while ago by Bloomsbury. So I'm going to be writing a book called How to Write Haiku. And my partner reminded me that I had this idea more than 15 years ago, or about 15 years ago. And actually, when we were living in Aotearoa, I put in an application to Creative New Zealand to fund the writing of such a book. I didn't get it, but, you know, at the time I was planning it. And it sort of keeps coming back. So I'm excited about that. You know, I've written quite a few articles about haiku that can sort of feed into it. I'm allowed to recycle a certain amount of material as far as the publisher is concerned. But yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun putting that together. So I'm going to look at haiku, but all the related forms of as well, like renga and tanka and haibun. And for a long time, I've been taking haibun, which is prose, and haiku interspersed as a model for other hybrid forms. So that's part of the inspiration behind my fusion poems, for example. So I'm looking a lot at hybridity in terms of, you know, opening out from here. Here's these traditional forms of haiku and haibun and similar things. Let's write them. They're wonderful. But what else can we learn, again, that's transferable to other forms or that could become other forms? So hybridity is kind of a buzzword, and I'm going to be presenting a number of workshops at different universities on hybridity. And hybridity is sort of becoming quite prevalent in academic writing as well. Like I write a lot of what I call critical creative essays, where I'm basically writing theoretical discursive examination of a topic, but I'm also throwing some poems into the mix that address the same topic in a different way, and they speak to each other and give you different ways of talking about that thing. So that's quite exciting. So I think I've worked out a workshop that will be useful to people who write creatively or write various kinds of essays.
I think the hybrid aspect of it is in a realm where you are restricted by the word or by sounds, it sort of gives you wider wings. You do so much, right? You just have you are a juggler, right? You always have a lot of balls in the air, it seems. You have a podcast coming out.
Oh, yeah. I did an interview yesterday. I recently published an article about what we call the Defense Arts Program. So I teach on this special program that happens twice a year. It's a month-long intensive with members of the armed services and some emergency services personnel who are injured or been diagnosed with PTSD or anxiety disorder or something like that. And we use creative writing with those people. And I've written several articles about what we do on that program. This one's sort of about how I use creative writing myself to keep me healthy. You know, so it's about, you know, creative writing as a therapeutic intervention. And this is quite an autoethnographic piece where I'm sort of studying my own reactions, if you like. So the journal that published that, Journal of Creative Arts Therapies, has a monthly podcast, and they asked me to talk about the paper on that. So that's coming out very soon.
So if someone wanted to find it, they could just Google...
Yeah, Journal of Creative Arts Therapies, or JOCAT.
JOCAT,
and you'll see it on their podcast list, yeah.
I wondered maybe if you could read a Haibun, or unless you want to read something recent.
I've got another, let me see. Or maybe a fun one.
Let's go with something with humor.
Okay, so... going back to Pancakes for Neptune, so there are a couple of poems about some very weird, absolutely true events. And this is one of my favorite, this is a favorite moment in my life, I guess. It happened in Canberra. It was a party to celebrate the end of a festival. I think it was the Contour 556 festival. Lake Burley Griffin sits on Contour 556, and there was a festival of that name every 2 years for a little while, and I was involved with some events then, and there was this party at the end, and this is called Karaoke Poem. I've just walked in, late for the party. The host thrusts a laminated card in my hand, asks me to sing. A man I've never met, dressed in a kimono, all reds and pinks, and a curly blonde wig, says, "I've been waiting for you to come and sing with me. How about Up Where We Belong?" It's a chance to try out a Joe Cocker impersonation. I start off as Jennifer Warnes, and we switch partway along. I didn't plan to do karaoke. It's like walking into a pet shop and coming out with a monkey. "You channeled Joe Cocker. It was a gift to the world. I never got to see him, but now I have. I heard him in Sydney. You were just like him." I drink 2 glasses of water, walk over the bridge, catch the bus home. Who knows what tomorrow brings?
Our guest today on Poetry on the Radio has been Owen Bullock, a Cornwall-raised, Canberra-based poet who spent many years living in New Zealand. He currently teaches at the University of Canberra. His most recent book, Pancakes for Neptune, appeared in 2023 from Recent Work Press, and thanks to the press for supplying us with a copy of that book. Our guest next time on Poetry on the Radio will be Barina South. I'm Kimberly K. Williams.
Poetry on the Radio is heard Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and Mondays at 10:30 p.m. on ArtSound FM.